The date is January 1st, 1349, and London is gripped by the Black Death. In houses and buildings, all along its narrow streets, hundreds of residents cough loud, hacking barks. The process incredibly painful, and they project blood and plague-filled detritus across the rooms they're in. They have high fevers, making their reactions more pathetic, as each cough is painful and nasty. Between the coughs, they try and breathe, but their breathing is shallow, short, almost a pant, and like the coughing, it hurts them. They suffer from pneumonic plague, the airborne version of the disease that has gripped the city these last 2 months. Outside, it is bitterly cold and wet, while inside they shiver in pain and fever and cough... Their loved ones try to take care of them, a doting mother terrified as to the fate of her child, a loving husband holding the hand and feeling the brow of his sickly wife. And thus the disease spreads between those with ties of love. How many suffered alone, avoided by the healthy and the living, because the truth was, for most of those infected, they had, at best, 3 days to live. Maybe 1 in 11 people would survive this attack, and that was still pure luck. As the dead began to mount up, the quick wandered the streets still and fulfilled the rituals of daily life as best they could. In this era, there was no support, no social safety net, no way to isolate. Long-term food storage was non-existent. You needed to earn to eat and go out and buy food to take home to eat. Those who supplied the food still had to travel to sell their goods. Life had to carry on or else life would stop. And so you went out into the cold and the rain, wrapped up as best you could. And around you were people, many of whom were coughing. Light coughs, but still. But remember, no one knew of germ theory. The idea that coughs could cause infections was unknown. People were not covering up. Others in the city did not die from this cough. They were feverish and lethargic, with unsightly buboes on them, and who stank. Supposedly the same disease, but presenting differently. You walked the streets and hoped God would protect you. You would say a litany of prayers each time you left the house. You would attend Mass once, twice, even 3 times a week. Maybe you would join in ragged processions, begging for intercession from the Almighty. This was your life. The epidemic was in full swing and the dead were mounting up. On a good day, 20 would die. But as January came along, over 60 a day would fall prey to it. And the infection continued to spread and disseminate around the population. Welcome to hell. Welcome to London. Hi there, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London. This is a podcast that tries to tell the entire history of London in as much detail as possible. The story tries to relate to modern audiences the reality of the past and is about drinking deep of things that mattered to Londoners at the time. It takes a chronological approach, insisting that we follow along year after year, month after month. And this is the second part of a special 2 episodes part of the tale created to tell the story of the first arrival of the plague. While each episode stands alone, this one is a direct follow-on to the events in Chapter 122 and will be easier to follow if you'd listen to that one. So, without further ado, I'd like to welcome you to Chapter 123 of The Story of London, The Orphans of London. There is a passage written in the great Italian work, the Decameron, about the outbreak of this disease in Florence, written at the same time as the outbreak in London, that stands out across the many years since it was written as a painful evocation of conditions during the Black Death. Quote, being confined to their own parts of the city, they fell ill in their thousands, and since they had no one to assist them or attend to their needs, they inevitably perished almost without exception. Many dropped dead in the open streets, both by day and by night, while a great many others, though dying in their own houses, drew their neighbours' attention to the fact more by the smell of their rotting corpses than by any other means. Unquote. While the mainstay of the plague hitting London in the winter of 1348 seemed to be more an airborne version of the lymphatic impacting bubonic version that was hitting Florence the summer before, it was the same disease, and the death toll truly began to rise. We see the speed of it, the ferocious intensity of it. On January 7th, the shipwright John Palmer made his will, bequeathing his tenements to his wife Amy and requesting burial at the churchyard of All Hallows, Barking. Within 24 hours, Amy had drawn up her own will, requesting that her tenements received, quote, off her late husband, unquote, be sold to pay a debt and maintain her son Alan. John had evidently made his will and died within a day. A landlord and shipbuilder down in the region where the waterfront and the Tower of London met, based on his wish to be buried in All Hallows. To the residents of that region, called Petite Wales, the plague was fully amongst them, and his wife appeared to join him soon after. The girdler Stephen de Walton made his will on the 2nd of February. He wanted to be buried in the churchyard of St. Lawrence Jewry and left his tenement to his wife Marguerite, but she died within a week of him. We have a similar case with a woman called Joanna Emiel. She was the daughter of a chandler who made her will on the 8th of February. Joanna wanted to be buried in the churchyard of St. Bartolph Aldgate and left part of her estate to her sister Christina. Within 10 days, Joanna was dead and her sister followed 3 days afterwards. Many of the preparations people were making are being done hastily because people realised the moment they started showing signs of the disease, they were doomed. The rich widow Johanna Eales, whose husband had already been taken, wrote up her will on the 5th of February. She was probably already coughing up blood when she did. She was desperate to secure the fortunes of her son and daughter, Richard and Joanna. She set out a share of tenements in St. Bride, Fleet Street and St. Dunstan in the West between them and made specific requests of beds, pots and pans that each of her children was to receive. They were only children, so she also wrote down that they would be looked after by her mother. And she died 3 days later. That January 1349, the formal records of the Court of Hustings saw in 1 week alone 18 wills were being made. That's a year's worth in a normal year. And by the end of February, a further 22 wills had been added to the rolls. And as I said last episode, these wills were being written by the richest of London's population. The poorer mainstay of the city suffered just as much, only no record exists for them. We try to get a glimpse from the records of places around the city, the myriad of small towns and communities that had existed on London's doorstep, to get an idea of just how hard the plague was hitting the poorer people. The Bishop of London's manorial court up at Stepney sat again on the 20th of January, some 7 weeks after the last session. In those weeks, 27 of the bishop's tenants had died at a rate of 2 deaths every 3 days from a single manor. The following court, held just 3 weeks later, confirmed that a further 61 tenants had died, indicating that the mortality rate was doubling. We see whole families up there devastated by the disease, like that of John Bishcops, who died along with two of his sons, John and Peter, leaving only one sole surviving child, William. It was clear by the end of January the death toll was becoming unmanageable. With corpses mounting up, even with the new cemetery opened up by the bishop in West Smithfield, a new emergency cemetery was needed to supplement this one. An early 16th century document, based upon 14th century records, described how the, quote, violent pestilence killed such a great multitude that the existing cemeteries were insufficient, for which reason very many were compelled to bury their dead in places unseemly and not hallowed or blessed. For some, it was said, cast corpses into the river, unquote. The idea of plague victims being carried up and down the Thames on her strong tide is an image that would haunt Londoners today, let alone back then. The solution came from one of Edward III's most trusted advisers, Sir Walter de Morny. De Morny, in 1349, was the Marshal of Marshalsea Prison in Southwark, and he was also a veteran of the King's Wars in France, a diplomat, an admiral, and an all-round stalwart of the King's regime. In January of 1349, he was the most high-profile of figures to realise that the new emergency cemetery, created just a few months earlier by the Bishop of London to the north of the city, was rapidly filling up, and that someone had to do something to help. He immediately began to arrange to expand emergency burial conditions. He leased from St. Bart's Hospital, quote, an enclosed space for the purpose of a burying ground for those who died of pestilence, called Spittlecroft, at 12 marks a year, unquote. With the deal he made with them that it was only leased to begin with, but if he constructed a chapel on the site, he'd get to own it. It was basically a large field. This was to become the cemetery of the poor strangers. That was the exact word used to describe who this cemetery was for. The peregrinorum, the dead who were not residents of the city. Now that term, as we can tell from recent episodes, had a double meaning. It could refer to poor folk who had fled to London in the face of the plague from the countryside, but it actually also mostly applied to those who were living in the city but who were not designated citizens, and they numbered in their thousands. The land was leased for the purpose of burying them, and once it was, Bishop Stanford of London then, quote, assembled a great multitude, and with solemn procession came to the cemetery site, dedicating it in the honour of the Holy and Undivided Trinity and the Annunciation of Our Lady, unquote. We do not know the exact date of the consecration, but the cemetery was already in use by January 26, 1349. According to Geoffrey de Baker, the cemetery was called New Church y Hor, and that a chapel was founded there specifically for the burial of the dead. Another eyewitness of the plague in London, Robert of Aylesbury, reported that between Candlemas, the 2nd of February, and Easter, the 12th of April, quote, more than 200 bodies were carried to this cemetery for burial almost every day, unquote. And that would have amounted to about 14,000 over the 70-day period described. How such numbers were transported to the cemetery is not specified, but accounts from the nearby town of Rochester throw up some horrible illustrations. Quote, this mortality devoured such a multitude of both sexes that no one could be found to carry the corpses of the dead to burial, but men and women carried the bodies of their own little ones to church on their shoulders and threw them into mass graves, from which arose such a stink that it was barely possible for anyone to go past the churchyard, unquote. London's Aldersgate now became the doorway to a liminal space of death, with bodies emerging roughly one every 5 minutes as ragged processions of those carrying the dead made their traumatised ways to the new mass grave. It is found today under Charterhouse Square and is the site of the London Charterhouse. But while life tried to carry on as best it could by the end of January, the King gave instructions to the Royal Justices of the King's Bench, quote, mindful of the terrible pestilence of vast deadliness, daily increasing in the City of London and neighbouring parts, we do not wish any danger to threaten you, your sergeants, clerks, or any other officers of the said bench, nor the people transacting their business there. With the assent of the bishops, earls, barons, and others of our council staying at Langley, we have given instruction that all pleas before you at the bench are to be held over, unquote. London's royal law courts were closed down. The King initially thought this would last for just a few weeks. As it was, they didn't start up again until the following September. By January 1349, we see an unusual event take place in London, even with the pandemic erupting. A man called Robert de Welcoult claimed that on the 23rd of that month, five men ejected him from his rightful hold of three tenements in the parish of St. Leonard Candlewick Street, and they did it by force of arms. It appears that these were homes left vacant by the dead, and this gang was depossessing them from the landlord. This was not the only case of that kind of thing during the outbreak, but it was the only one enforced by violence. And yet, despite things like this, London endured and tried to carry on. Mayor Lovkin showed that remarkable tenacity of the city by insisting that he and the city aldermen continued to meet. They continued to record wills and charters in the Hustings Court. We see that on the 14th of January, 8 elected shearmen brought the ordinances for the governance of their guild before the mayor to be ratified by the city. These were, although out of those 8 shearmen, 6 would be dead or missing within weeks. Meanwhile, the court up at Stepney met on the 11th of February and reported a further 61 deaths in 3 weeks since the 20th of January. The manor's estimated toll for the whole of February was an extraordinary 75 dead people, and that was to be the highest during the outbreak. And it did appear that the plague peaked in the smaller villages making up the manor as much as 6 weeks before it reached a peak in the city. I mean, similarly, in the much smaller manor of Vauxhall, the court recorded 11 deaths between the 1st of January and the 11th of February. But London endured. Trade and commerce continued. I mean, between the 28th of January and the 5th of February, the collectors in the Port of London paid, on behalf of the king, a total of £517, 7 shillings and 9.5 pence for 388 sacks, that's over 63 tons, of wool, shipped from King's Lynn to the city by men of 9 different merchants, several of which were London woolmongers. Wine, too, continued to flow through the city, as did fraud. There is a case of 2 Basque wine merchants who had set out from Lisbon with 261 tons of wine round about late January or early February. While awaiting fair weather to emerge in a port in Brittany, their ships had been impounded illegally by Thomas Dagworth, who was King Edward's administrator in that region. Dagworth confiscated all their wine and had it shipped to English ports, including London, and then sold it for his own profit. The outraged merchants turned up in England and appealed to the king, and on the 12th of February, he commanded the sheriffs of London to organise a search of all the wine cellars and other wine stores in the city to locate any of the missing wine. This is during a pandemic. By March, the rate at which Londoners were preparing their wills increased again. No fewer than 89 were drawn up this month, 12 of them on a single day, the 12th. Over 1/4 of this total were dead before the months without, and a total of 61 wills were enrolled. However, it is clear that the system for enrolling wills and the administrative network of the city was starting to show some signs of strains. We actually begin to see some post-dated wills. With such an elevated mortality rate in the city, the deaths of members of more than one generation within individual families actually made inheritances really much more complex. Richard the Sordich had drawn up his will on the 10th of February and was dead by the beginning of March. We don't actually know what his profession was, but in the will he left a tenement in St. Olave Jewry to his son John and goods and money to Benedict and Margaret, his other children. Richard's wife Marjorie had died earlier, and her family had already inherited property from her. Son Benedict had received land in the parish of St. Stephen Coleman Church. In the grip of the plague, Benedict drew up his own will on the 6th of March 1349. He was dead himself by the 16th. Father and son appeared on the hustings rolls, almost next door to each other. Benedict was obviously one of the executors of his father's will, but had no time at all to accomplish the execution. In his own will, he's only able to set aside the land his mother left him for a chantry in St. Olave, and to request his master, John Lacer, to act in his stead as executor of his father's undischarged will. John Lacer, in his turn, may well have been the man of that name whose own will was drawn up in April and who died by the beginning of May. So what we're seeing is property passing within days from father to son to executor to executor's nominee, and the risks of maintaining a clear trail of ownership are obvious to all, I would assume. The emergency cemeteries founded by Bishop Stranford and Walter de Mornay had also featured for the first time in the wills of Londoners by that March. They had very rapidly become incorporated into the city landscape. The will of Gerald Lumineux was drawn up on the 3rd of March. He probably lived in the parish of St. Bride, Fleet Street, and made arrangements to leave his estate to his wife and his son and daughter, Ralph and Isabella, with the clause that if no heir could be forthcoming from them, he would, quote, leave and ordain that the said possession shall descend to the new chapel of the Virgin Mary outside Aldersgate to have and hold in perpetuity, unquote. This is the earliest reference to the chapel that Walter Mauney had set to build in his extended cemetery of the poor strangers, and indicates that at the very least groundwork or other preparatory activities for the chapel, such as stockpiling building materials, were well underway, and that some citizens were aware and supportive of this project. The formal foundation ceremony of the chapel took place some 3 weeks after this was done, according to the Charterhouse Register. On the 25th of March, the Bishop of London, quote, with the Mayor of the City and the Sheriffs, as well as the more eminent citizens, who are called aldermen, and many others, nearly all barefoot, and with a most devout procession, went to the said cemetery, and there the Bishop celebrated and preached a solemn sermon to the people. On the same day, the Mayor laid the foundation of the chapel, unquote. Such a procession, leading as it had been done from the Guildhall itself via the cathedral and then right out through Aldersgate towards the cemetery, would have been quite an occasion at the height of the crisis, and would certainly have served to give hope to the beleaguered citizens. That chapel survived to become the church of the later Carthusian Monastery of Charterhouse, as we said. The West Smithfield cemeteries were evidently still insufficient to cope with the numbers of dead that were piling up. More space for burial was required, and consequently, a third plague cemetery was established, again just beyond the walls, on the eastern side of the city at Tower Hill. The origin of this cemetery is somewhat less clear than those over in West Smithfield, but it must have been founded just a little after them. The scale of this cemetery was not as large as De Murray's. It was about 4 acres in all, and it was walled around with an earthen bank. Exactly when it was consecrated is not stated, but a priory document in the mid-1360s cites the inadequacy of existing space for burial victims as the reason, so it was probably after November 1348, and the best guess is in January or February of 1349, perhaps only a few weeks after De Mauney Cemetery. The scale of the pestilence continued to interfere with the running of the kingdom and the city. On the 10th of March, the king accepted the fact that his postponement of the January Parliament would effectively have to be indefinite. He wrote, quote, whereas lately, by reason of the deadly pestilence then prevailing, we caused Parliament, that was to be summoned to meet at Westminster on the Monday after the Feast of St. Hilary, to be prorogued until the Quinzine of Easter next, and because the aforesaid pestilence is increasing with more than its usual severity in Westminster and in the City of London and the surrounding districts, whereby the coming of the magnates and other of our faithful lieges to that place at this time would probably be too dangerous. For this and for certain other obvious reasons, we have thought it fit to postpone the said Parliament until we shall issue further summons, unquote. Parliament was prorogued, but royal business did carry on in this time, especially the undertaking of Inquisition's post-mortem. Over in the new cemetery by the Tower of London, we know from burial patterns that the original victims had been buried individually, but by now they had reverted to using large pits. One notable feature was, it seems, that London insisted that all the victims were to be buried in coffins. We have no records of the many hundreds of tons of wood required to construct the thousands of coffins needed, but we also know from later archaeological finds most people were buried dressed. It's not possible to say they were buried in clothing they died in. There does seem to be evidence to suggest they may have been specifically dressed in funeral clothing, a small dignity, but one which carried risk. On the 24th of March, the day before the commonalty of London were due to go barefoot to De Mauney's new chapel site, King Edward issued an indenture to three Italians, John Durante, Philip John de Nier of Florence, and Benedict Isban of Lucca, and they were charged to make three types of gold coin in the Tower of London. The largest was the gold noble, which was then worth 6 shillings and 8 pence. There was also a bunch of other smaller gold coins and a range of silver coins. This agreement was witnessed by several London merchants who clearly had a direct interest in the issuing of new coins. Once again, the city and business life carrying on even in the midst of a terrible pandemic. The mayor and the sheriffs, who had not met to consider pleas since September the year before, met once in March, showing that the business of justice continued in at least some form in the city, despite the utter severity of the crisis. One man from Kent, called John Shonkey, who had been confined to Newgate Prison in connection to an unpaid debt to a man called Robert Cross, a fishmonger's son. Claiming that he already paid off the debt, Shong Kim sought justice in court. Cross denied that payment had been made, but a jury found for the plaintiff, who received 100 shillings in damages, while his creditor replaced him in jail. The civic authorities, like the king, found need to replace lost officers. And on the 20th of March, Thomas de Newport was admitted sergeant of the Chamber of Guildhall by the mayor, aldermen, and the commonalty. Unfortunately, he was dead within a month. The trade guilds, too, must have been very badly hit, certainly of the three bailiffs of the Weavers' Company elected in November 1348. One was dead by the 4th of March, and the second by the 19th. And by April of 1349, the plague in London reached its height. With warmer weather now, we can assume that the pneumonic plague had been superseded by its bubonic variant, and now the disease was spreading along narrow streets without need for a cough. This peak in the city came some 6 weeks after it peaked in the nearby manor of Stepney. No fewer than 104 wills were drawn up during this 1 month, 7 on Easter Sunday alone, suggesting that many, if not most, wealthy Londoners were now convinced they could no longer expect to survive and thus had to make preparations for their death. And the wills show that in the overwhelming face of such death, those making them out were now not just worrying about surviving, but also about the survival of those they asked to execute their wills. They would often hedge their bets. David of Kingston, in his will of 3rd of April, bequeathed his properties in the parish of St. Margaret Lothbury to his children, Simon and Johanna. He appointed as guardians two men, John Lucas for his son and John de Hurlaw for his daughter. The rich mercer Colwell made his will on the same date, and in it he appointed two other mercers as guardians of his children, leaving his wife as guardian for his second son. Isabella Godcheap, in her will drawn up on Easter Sunday, appointed multiple guardians for her grandson. By such tactics, the chances of at least one child retaining an adult carer of the parent's choice was greatly enhanced. Forced to take account of the extraordinary, rapidly evolving, terrible situation around them, some of the wealthier families looked to the city to act as a safety net should their best-laid plans falter. Adam Aspel was a wealthy skinner with properties on Bread Street, Cornhill and Billingsgate. He left these to his wife, Unchilla, in his will dated the 15th of April, with some additional estates to his sons, John and Richard, and his daughter, Juliana, probably knowing he was dying. The will contained the prescient clause that Unchilla's property should be sold after her death to pay Adam's debts. Unchilla wrote her will just 6 days later, and she too was dead days after making it. The key fact in her will is that she had previously agreed to act as a guardian for the children of a fishmonger, a man called John de Newport, who wished now to pass money received for this purpose into the care of the Chamberlain of Guildhall, at this time one Thomas de Marins, until all the children involved came of age. Such wards of the city could then be passed on to suitable guardians chosen by the mayor and the aldermen. An example of this is actually found in the city letter books. On the 22nd of April, the mayor and the alderman gave to a man from Bedfordshire the guardianship of three sons of a Londoner called Hugh de Polsoner. Presumably this meant the young boys started a new life away from the city. Others tried to cover themselves by using religious fraternities. Fraternities were essentially religious societies, more often than not associated with a single craft or trade, and usually focused on a specific church. Long-term listeners may have heard me refer to the religious fraternity of the Church of St. Anselm, which was almost exclusively populated by pepperers. Their members were drawn from the same upper and middle strata of society as the Hustings willmakers, and membership ensured, amongst other things, that upon death the affairs of the deceased will be discharged and a suitable funeral will be held with mourners drawn from the fraternity itself. And these had existed for a while, so such things could be easily organised. By that April, their attractiveness obviously grew. John de Shenfield the Tanner left in his will of the 1st of April a tenement to the fraternity of the Light of St. Mary in the Church of St. Sepulchre, Newgate. William de Frit, a mercer, on the 5th of April, and Nicholas de Rothi, a salter, on the 12th of April, left property to the fraternity of Corpus Christi in Allhallows Bread Street. Also on that date, Andrew Cross, the fishmonger, left money to the fraternity of St. Magnus on Bridge Street. Some bequests were more specific in their aims to support the fraternity's activities. Others were just desperate for a safety net. And still, the dead mounted up. In a tenement on Thames Street was a young boy and his family. This boy was only 9 years old, and his name was Geoffrey Chaucer. He survived the plague, but his father buried three brothers and half-brothers and his step-grandfather, Richard Chaucer. Though no will survives, we know the prior of Westminster Abbey, one Simon de Hommensham, also perished at the beginning of April. A monk called Simon de Langham was swiftly elected in his place, but was to spend less than 7 weeks in office before being elevated to the position of abbot because the abbot had died. Such were the opportunities that accompanied this extraordinary death rate. Similar events were occurring in St. Paul's Cathedral as canons there succumbed and were replaced. To gauge how many people were dying at this appalling height of the disaster, we must look forward to the wills that were enrolled in May once the backlog that had just emerged was cleared. The total, 121, is the highest of any time during the 1349 plague. The figure represented over 40 times the average monthly death rate recorded by such things in the decade before the plague. If extended to all the inhabitants of 60,000 souls, this would produce a mortality rate very much in line with the claims of over 200 burials a day between February and April. Outside the city walls in the manor of Stepney, the number of deaths was now diminishing, but slowly. And yet, here and now, London was becoming a brutal hellscape of death and rot. On the 8th of April, the King wrote to John Lufkin, the mayor of the city, about the condition of the streets, and in unequivocal language, he ordered that, quote, human feces and other filth lying in the street and lanes of the city and its suburbs should be removed with all speed to places far distant, unquote, and that the mayor should, quote, cause the city and the suburbs to be cleared from all odour and to be kept clean as it used to be in the time of the preceding mayors, so that no greater cause of mortality may arise from such smells, unquote. The city and the suburbs, quote, under the mayor's care and rule, are so foul by the filth thrown out of the houses by day and by night into the streets and lanes that the air is infected and the city is poisoned, unquote. The situation had been caused simply by, it seems, that the carters and rakers, whose job it was to clean rubbish and odour of the streets, they were dying or had died off in numbers. They weren't rich enough to keep wills, so we cannot be sure. But it's clear from the complaint that the service they provided was no longer able to be done, which suggests the plague had carried off its members. Not only were the carters and rakers being decimated, we know that the ale tasters, responsible for the quality of ale sold in the city, in Stratford, Aldgate Street and Holywell Street, were reported to be dead. And we can readily imagine the impact upon other trades, crafts and services vital to the basic functioning of London at this time. April was to prove difficult for the city administration in other ways too. Thomas Manners, the long-serving Chamberlain of London, became victim of the plague. He made his will on the 22nd of April, and then on the 23rd, with the permission of the mayor and the city recorder, took care of outstanding business while he still could, certainly farming out the office of bailiff of Southwark to somebody for about 2 years, and his death was recorded 2 days later. A new sergeant at the Guildhall was admitted on the 20th April, indicating that the previous incumbent had lasted in the post for less than a month. The royal infrastructure sustained losses too. Thomas de Clopton, keeper of the Great Wardrobe, was certainly alive in March 1349, and equally certainly dead by June. As April came to an end, the plague seemed to grip London tighter and tighter. Death seemed everywhere, and then, slowly, the first rays of hope began to be seen that May. We see the number of wills being drawn up dropped considerably, still very high rate, but just over half the previous month's tally, and that began a downward trend. Robert of Avesbury, one of London's eyewitnesses, wrote that, quote, the plague ceased in London with the coming of the grace of the Holy Spirit, unquote. He meant the 31st of May. And while a complete cessation cannot be substantiated looking at the evidence around it, a clear change in language in reference to the plague can be detected from about mid-June onwards. London began to imagine an aftermath. All of London's hospitals had been devastated by the plague, given their particular responsibilities towards the poor and sick of the city. Certainly at St. Thomas Southwark, so many brethren had been killed by the end of May that William Edlington, the Bishop of Winchester, appealed to the Pope for permission to elect Walter de Marlow as the prior, despite the fact that he was actually illegitimate. At the leper house at St. John's Westminster, the warden and all the brothers and sisters were killed, except William de Weston, who was made its master that May. London began the business of returning to life. A small number of documents refer again to construction work starting. On the 6th of May, work began to expand the church chancel of All Hallows Bread Street. Similarly, on the grander scale, the Carmelite friars in London were licensed to enclose Croker's Lane, which ran down the entire western side of the friary from Fleet Street to the river. Another indication that the worst of the plague had passed was suddenly we see numbers coming forward to reclaim debts owed them, an eternal London favourite pastime. Although the plague did keep making this difficult. On the 5th of May, the King Steward, Philip de Weston, ordered the sheriffs of London to seize the assets of a man called Henry Waymond, who was in debt to the Crown. Unfortunately, Waymond, a woolmonger, had made his will a week before and had died on the same day as the notice was issued for him. Perhaps more significantly, the assize of nuisance, which had been suspended since September 1348, was revived on the 28th of May, and the first case heard is reassuringly domestic in nature. A man called John de Hardhangham, who was a resident of St. Mary Axe, wished to complain that a couple, John and Henry Atterwood, and their neighbour, Alice Powell, a widow of a bell founder, were refusing to build a ruinous earthen wall 80 feet long and running along their garden northward of John's property. The mundane nature of this complaint is a clear sign that life was beginning to start again. Meetings of some of the London guilds were also resumed at this time. The Mercers Guild certainly met in June and July, perhaps for the first time all year. If all this evidence points to a lessening of the plague, it was not, as we said, a cessation, and dark days would continue for some time yet. The King's own surgeon, Roger de Hayton, perished on the 13th of May. And yet, slowly but surely, the plague did begin to lessen. People did begin to return to work. But there were many less people than there had been. And this led to what was the most significant event of that summer beyond the plague itself. King Edward III's Ordinance of Labourers, issued on the 18th of June. The King presented a writ to every sheriff and bishop in England, setting out a response to what he saw as an alarming rise in inflation driven by spiralling wages caused by a sudden multitude of deaths and a shortage of manpower. This ordinance pointed out that a, quote, great part of the population has now died in this pestilence, unquote. And as a result of that, contracted workers were refusing to work unless they were paid an increased salary. The King concluded that many, quote, preferred to beg in idleness than to work for their living, unquote. He issued new rules that were draconian and clearly a brutal emergency measure. Everyone under the age of 60 and who were not poorly, having neither a trade, profession, craft or private lands and means, and currently unemployed, had to work at a rate of wages at the levels they were in 1346. And anyone who said no was to be jailed and remain in jail until they complied with this. No employer was allowed to pay workers any wages beyond what they used to pay them in 1346. And any who did would be tried with a forfeiture of twice or triple the offered wage to anyone who'd lost workers because they went off to find better wages. Any workers currently on a higher rate due to manpower shortage, they had to revert back to 1346 levels. In the countryside, reapers and mowers were forbidden to leave their current employment before the agreed term was completed, or else be jailed. And in places like London, well, the saddlers, the skinners, the toyers, the cobblers, the tailors, the smiths, the carpenters, the masons, the tilers, the shipwrights, the carters, and all other artisans and labourers were ordered to work for 1346 wage levels. The butchers, fishmongers, innkeepers, brewers, bakers, poulterers, and all the other dealers in food were then ordered to sell their goods at a reasonable price. Those charging higher rates due to, you know, inflation, would be fined twice the sum. And any bailiff who felt sorry for these people and didn't enforce this law would pay three times the fine. Oh, and any and all beggars who were able to work were forbidden from receiving any charity. They had to get out and work. This was brutal. Let's be honest, it was an attempt to hold off the effects of a diminishing labour pool. But for the survivors of the contagion, which was still happening around them, even though it was diminished, this was the source of much traumatised resentment. The fact the king had to issue this ordinance alone just shows you how brutal the death toll had been. As the summer wore on, the plague was mostly ravaging the north of England, even though London still had cases raging on, and yet this ordinance of labourers was enforced upon the residents of the city brutally. On the 18th of July, William de Osfager, Ralph Utter Hoke, John Shumphreys, William de Brevigny, John de Maniers, and Martin Le Mainer at Holborn, and other baker's servants, were indicted for forming a conspiracy amongst themselves that they would not work for their masters except that double or treble the wages they were formerly given. Truly, it must have been a miserable time for the low paid. Their income had been capped despite the price rises that were being permitted. In other words, we think we had a harsh cost of living crisis. And compounding matters, they were required to cover themselves for months before payment could come in, because their employers were only meant to pay them at the end of each month rather than weekly. These measures were incredibly unpopular and, quote, occasioned greater hardships and even the pestilence. For whilst the latter made labour scarce and had conduced to higher wages, the ordinances offered wages to the labourer that it was worse than slavery to accept, unquote. While this was happening, the dead still continued, suffering under the stench of the buboes. Walter Boll, the master mason at Westminster Abbey, John Habrinter, the distinctly named rector of St. Mary Magdalene on Fish Street, the goldsmith, John de Toppesfeld, and his mother, Johanna, the shipwright, John Palmer, and his wife, Amy, are just some of those who died in July and August. On the 20th of July, we see a new chaplain appointed to the church of St. James Garlickhide to replace the one who just died. The chaplain, William de Whiten, held the post for just 3 weeks before he died, and another man called Roger de Stepford took over. The glazier and supplier of glass to Westminster, Richard Yenge, died that summer, along with Robert de Doncaster, the keeper of the King's Lions at the Tower of London. And we know that in this aftermath, that even with the ordinances gathering up any unemployed to work, a document at the time refers to, quote, those who having been reduced from affluence to poverty are ashamed to get a living by begging, and those poor men who come up from the rural districts of the City of London to get a living by selling brushwood, timber, heather, and other things, unquote. This is perhaps our clearest evidence of the immediate human consequence in the city, both of the plague itself and of the brutal ordinance of labourers. A similarly pathetic image is conjured by the imprisonment on the 20th of April of three men for using false nets in the Thames on the east side of London. There they wanted to catch, quote, three bushels of small fish, which fish, by reason of their smallness, could be of no use to anyone, unquote. Of course, as the plague began to diminish, another issue arose. The children who survived the great mortality, the orphans of London. There was a sudden uptick in the number of cases involving orphan children in the mayor's court as the year went on. We see cases like the goldsmith Richard de Basingstoke, who died of the plague in early May. At the end of July, his son, aged just 1.5 years, was committed to the care of John de Deppley and his wife Joanna, described as the child's mother. Joanna, having lost her husband, had evidently remarried within 2 months. A situation that may well have repeated itself, many times across the city. The impact on London's social networks and family ties must have been profound. Trade networks also played a significant part in the care of orphans of wealthier citizens. Roger Seward, a pewterer, made a will on the 30th of October in 1348, which mentioned a wife and 6 children. Roger, his wife and 3 of the children, were already dead by the following August, when guardianship of the surviving offspring, William, Mary and Thomas, was committed to John Seward, also a pewterer. Such mechanisms of social care for the wealthier families serve also to remind us how very vulnerable the surviving poor of the city must have been, and there's no written evidence for the strategies they employed. But it has to be assumed that the weaker members of society, the disabled, the elderly, and the children who had lost their principal supporting family, must have been left in dire straits. Greed tempted at least some guardians into keeping for themselves goods and estates that had been trusted to children of plague victims. In September, such cases began to come before the mayor and the alderman. On the 7th, Roger de Woodham, executor of the original executor of one John de Parmenter, was summoned to answer a complaint from Le Parmenter's close friends. They claimed that Woodham was withholding goods meant for the children of Le Parmenter. In court, he agreed he was holding £30, a signet ring, and other goods and chattels for them. He was made to pay 27 shillings and 2 pence for the goods and £30 in gold nobles to the city chamberlain. Goods and money were also at risk of theft until a formal handover could take place. On the 26th of August, 1349, friends of a dread draper, John de Selling, came to plead at court that John de Canterbridge, a chaplain, with his holding from Selling's daughters, Marguerite and Juliana, £10 left to them by their father. The money had been passed to Selling's executor, Henry de Ashendham, and on his death into the hands of his executor, John de Canterbridge. The latter pleaded that he had duly administered de Ashendham's estate, and only 5 marks were left. However, the jury found that he still had in his possession sufficient goods belonging to pay the £10 due to the children. Judgment was given to him to pay up. It was not just money and goods at risk during this time. The orphans themselves might be abducted. The will of John de Lecky, an ironmonger, left his daughter Alice in the guardianship of his wife Matilda. It also included provisions for a backup to be provided by his friend Thomas de Northerney. But he died, and 7 years later in 1356, a case was brought before the mayor and the alderman reporting that de Lecky's wife had died 3 weeks after her husband, and Stephen de Northerney, Thomas de Northerney's brother, had assumed guardianship of Alice, de Lecky's now orphan daughter, and had elonged with said Alice, aged 8 years, out of the city. The fate of the orphans of London, the child survivors of the plague, just gives us another small glimpse into the horror of the Black Death that year. And just before the end of the year, one final image of this plague comes to the city. Around Michaelmas, it was said, quote, more than 120 men, for the most part from Zealand or Holland, arrived in London from Flanders. They went barefoot in procession twice a day in the sight of the people, sometimes in St. Paul's Church, sometimes elsewhere in the city, their bodies naked except for a linen cloth from their loins to ankle. Each wore a hood painted with a red cross at front and back and carried in his right hand a whip with 3 thongs. Unquote. These were the flagellates, religious zealots who scourged themselves for the sins of the world and who had appeared as a movement a century before, but they had emerged early in the plague in response to its arrival. And the Pope detested them and ordered that King Edward should drive them out of his kingdom. And slowly but surely, the plague began to abate and life began to return. The guilds tried to rebuild themselves. The plague had carried off many elected representatives. In November 1349, an election was held to replace the 9 wardens of the Cutler's Guild who had died. It's noteworthy that only 6 new wardens could be named. Either the need for or the availability of suitable candidates had diminished by 1/3. The ordinance of labourers continued to cause trouble amongst London workers. And on the 21st of November, and again on 8th of December, the King felt compelled to issue another writ to the mayor and sheriffs to forbid artificers and others demanding higher wages than before the pestilence. And then on December the 1st, he issued a writ that the mayor and sheriffs of London that none should leave the kingdom, quote, except well-known merchants, insofar as the country had become so much depopulated by pestilence and the treasury exhausted, unquote. The city itself seems to become a magnet for migrants towards the end of the year. Quote, a great concourse of aliens and denizens, unquote, many armed and seemingly oblivious to any curfew, forced the city authorities to start arresting them. And on the 29th of December, King Edward placed full royal support behind these attempts to keep the king's peace, demanding punishment of all transgressors. quote, now that the pestilence is stayed, unquote. And while a few may have carried on dying into 1350, that was the end of the contagion, the Black Death, and the story of London can move on, only the plague wasn't gone for good. It would return. It was to remain friends with London for a very long time. Everything I've said in these last two chapters have been based on the work of better masters, historians like Philip Ziegler, Sean Martin, John Hatcher, and above all Barney Stone, whose amazing book The Black Death in London was crucial to all of this, were invaluable, and I heartily recommend all their work by those historians to anyone who wishes to dive deeper into the impact of the plague on the city. And with that, we come to an end of the tale of the Black Death, and now embrace the future of London's story. Book 5 of the story of London begins, and we move towards some amazing events, including the War of the Roses, but we're still a whiles to go yet. So with that, I will see you next week for chapter 124 of the story of London. Thanks for listening. This is Saul saying bye.